I'm Gene Kansas. You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. We cover the arts, architecture, design, development, city planning, preservation. Today's show, the curb market. In 1917, an enormous fire ravaged 75 blocks of Atlanta, leaving 1 mile of destruction in its wake. To replant the seeds of commerce, the city of Atlanta created an open-air market in what is now the Sweet Auburn Historic District. The gathering became so popular, a permanent structure was demanded, and the Women's Club of Atlanta helped raise the money to make it happen. The Municipal Market of Atlanta, as it's officially titled, opened its doors in 1924, selling produce, meats, and products to consumers of the day. The market was, in many ways, egalitarian, meant for people of all classes and color. But not everyone was allowed inside. African-American shoppers had to buy their goods from carts on the curb, prompting a nickname that still stands nearly 90 years later. Today, we affectionately call it the curb market.
Walking through the marketplace in New Orleans, I saw the man of my dreams. Pair of eyes I couldn't miss. Lips that were begging to be kissed. I went flying out in space. A handsome face, and I found that warm embrace at the marketplace.
My guests today are manager of the Sweet Auburn Curb Market, Pamela Joyner, Richard Loeb, director of Master and Heritage Preservation Program at Georgia State University, true New Yorker and owner of Sunday Gravy, Stephen Smith, celebrated chef and CEO of High Road Craft Ice Cream, Keith Schroeder, and the new executive director of the Atlanta Streetcar, Tim Borchers.
My name is Richard Loeb, and I'm the director of the Heritage Preservation Program at Georgia State University. It's in the history department.
What is heritage preservation?
Good question. And we differentiated a little bit from historic preservation because we are a little bit broader, I think. We have two tracks in our program. One track is the kind of traditional historic preservation track, where we look at buildings, communities, neighborhoods, sites, the physical environment, cemeteries, landscapes. We look at the physical environment and what's important historically about it and how to preserve those places. The other track we have is a public history track, where we teach students about museum studies, oral history, archives, exhibit planning and production, so that they can work in a more interpretive environment where they're providing history to a public audience, to a broader audience than an academic audience. So that's why I think one of our chief duties in preservation is education. I mean, to tell people why a place is important. People can walk down Auburn Avenue and see things, but if they don't understand the history and the meaning behind the places that they're seeing, they lose a lot of the importance of that place. And I think the market is one of those places where it's not only an economic place where people go and exchange goods and services, but also a cultural place where people, and I think the municipal market is a great example of that, where it was a community asset and people went there not only to shop, but also to see each other and to be part of a community and a culture. And not only that, but as a spinoff, preserves the neighborhoods around those places as well.
Tell us a little bit about the history of the market.
Sure. That's great. The market was first thought about after the 1917 fire in Atlanta, which devastated about 75 blocks of the city from about where the market is all the way to Ponce de Leon, north. A huge fire that lasted for about a day that really devastated the city. Right after that, in the location of where the market is now, they set up a big tent to allow farmers to come down and peddle their wares, and it became a very big success.
So the fire happens in 1917, and mm-hmm. then it becomes, this area is an open-air market starting in 1918,
right.
And then,
right.
then what?
And the Atlanta Women's Club decided that this was such a success that they needed to actually have a building built to be able to have this activity in a place that was safe and secure and out of the rain and a permanent home for the market. And so they purchased a piece of land and gave it to the city of Atlanta, and the city still owns the market and the piece of land it's on. In about 1920, they engaged an architect, Atenaik Brown, who was a famous architect in Atlanta, built was designer of things like the Fulton County Courthouse, the Clark County Courthouse in Athens, the old Peachtree Arcade, which is now gone, unfortunately, at Five Points, the New Orleans Courthouse, which is a huge building. So this was a famous architect at the time who practiced in Atlanta and engaged him to design a building. And I have a picture of it here for the radio. It's really, really
see nice that, y'all? Actually, you know what? Could you describe it for the listener?
Sure. It's a kind of a triangular-shaped building because of the way the city blocks were located. It was a kind of a one-and-a-half-story high building with towers at each end kind of to announce its presence. And in between those towers were long bays where you could either have shoppers shopping there or trucks pulling in or carts pulling in to unload goods. But there was a lot of interaction between the outside and the inside. And it's a really important point that when it was first built, African Americans were not allowed to come into the market or sell in the market. So African American producers of food or farmers had to sell on the curb. And this is the origin of the name, the curb market, because that's where African Americans bought and sold their goods.
But it's interesting because despite that commerce happening on the curb, white and black Atlanta were
together. They were intermingling. And this is a very important point, I think. There's not that many places that would occur. That would occur in, say, railroad terminals or perhaps government buildings. But the curb market, the municipal market, was a place where both black and whites came together, which was, at that time, a rare occurrence.
And so the building is erected and opens in, like, 1924?
May 1st, 1924, that's right. Yep. The building was very successful. One other aspect of the construction of the building, it was a fireproof building. It was made out of brick and concrete. Large open space inside, which makes it a very flexible space. You think about buildings being adaptable to other uses. This is a perfect example of a place that can morph, that can change. And it really has changed from more a grocery produce area to groceries plus the cafes and the shops and the restaurants as well. So it's adapted well to that change of uses. What we talk about in terms of sustainability in our program is not only the environmental sustainability of the materials, but also the economic sustainability of that place. Mm-hmm. But thirdly, the social aspects of it and the cultural aspects of it, which is something that, you know, Leeds doesn't really deal with, that social importance of saving the historic landmark. So I think that if we lost a building like the municipal market, it would be not only the loss of a functioning place, but also a landmark for people in their lives, and something that's important to them to see and to understand and to take advantage of.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Curb Market.
Well, you know, streetcars are often referred to as the needle and the thread that sewed communities together. They not only provided a way people could live inexpensively and get to and from work, but along the streetcar routes grew businesses, shops, movie theatres. So people just didn't use it for work purposes or to get their shopping, but they used it to recreate as well. In fact, a more modern cliched term, which is used for these new start streetcar systems, is transportainment. And that's what they were in the early days too.
Atlanta Streetcar Executive Director Tim Borchers.
The reason why streetcar systems grew in the early days was because land developers would buy some land just outside the city when it was cheap. People had horse and carts and muddy streets. It was very hard to commute. The land developer would put in an inexpensive streetcar line and say, listen, cheap land, ride my streetcar to and from work, to the shops, to the businesses, and what a great lifestyle. So people bought the land.
And that would be, and Inman Park would be an example of one
streetcar
of those.
Streetcar suburb, exactly. Right here in Atlanta. In fact, most large, older developed cities around the world are streetcar or tramway suburbs. So it was actually used to build and develop suburbs. Well, in about 2001, 2002, two systems opened in America, two new systems. The only original system still operating was, of course, New Orleans, the one around St. Charles, Tampa, Florida, and Portland. And they built the streetcar, and this enormous economic development occurred around the streetcar track. Intensive housing, commercial development, so successful that the industry is on a huge roll here with about 50 systems either running, under construction, or under design.
So that kicked off the Renaissance.
The success of the systems, yes. They thought we've discovered something new, something that works, something that can rebuild the decaying urban cores of cities. The streetcars build up these busy urban cores, where everyone would come into work, socialise, shop, work, then go away. The motor car decentralised this. So we began getting satellite suburbs and decentralisations. So the urban cores, and if you go along to all American large cities, or even cities in Australia or Europe or the UK, there'll be sections of the city that are dying, that are rotting. We're putting the streetcars back in, and it's revitalising those parts of the city.
So where do you think Atlanta's going? Where can it take us? Where can it take us as an individual? Where can it take us as a city?
Well, let's look at the type of people the streetcar is going to carry. The streetcar is going to carry not just a commuter audience, and first of all, but the commuter customers, they're going to be people that work downtown in offices that are choosing to live somewhere downtown in condos or apartments. They're going to be people who not just work during the day, but also work at night in the hospitality industry. They've got to get to and from work, so they'll be using the streetcar as commuters, but a different type of commuter. But after living downtown now, I've been in town for 4 months and I've spent the entire time living downtown, I've noticed the incredible number of conventions and things like the America's Mart. Those people, you go to your event during the day, then you finish at 5, 5.30 and you want to have a look at town. You want to go somewhere for a restaurant. But if you're downtown in a hotel, how do you get to the restaurant? Well, it's easy. There's a streetcar coming past every 10 or 15 minutes. You hop on the streetcar. For the first 3 months, it'll be free, and then it'll just be $1 a ride. So it's going to be easy to use. Plus, conventioneers are packaging up a special ticket just for conventioneers.
This show is about the curb market. Why is there a stop at the Auburn curb market?
Why? Because, and I'll look at the streetcar reason why. It's a ridership generator. A lot of people either go there or want to go there. That means people who are there might want to ride the streetcar, and people who want to ride the streetcar want to go to the market. The new Civil Rights Museum, the football centre. It's, the streetcar is going to link all these new attractions as well. And why are they on the route, and why do we have stops near there? Because they're ridership generators. One question we get asked a lot is, well, why don't you just put a bus in? Bus is cheaper. Doesn't carry as many people, causes a lot more pollution, but why not just put a bus in? And the reason is the economic development. If you get private and commercial and residential developers, if you suddenly put government money in the street, in concrete, they'll put money in around it because they know you can't change. A normal bus system, we can turn off tonight. With a streetcar system, you can't. The infrastructure's there. So they know there's a long-term investment, and they're prepared to put long-term private money in too. You look at it now.
Auburn Avenue.
You think that, well, you know, there's some development opportunities. In 3 years' time, that street will be completely different. There'll be fun, small shops serving a visitor and local audience that you wouldn't thought was possible. And I'm not saying this because I'm some sort of clairvoyant. I'm saying this because I've watched so many streetcar systems and what's going to happen. And that's what's going to happen to it. And there's two things that a streetcar system has to have to be successful. One is political will, and the other is will of the people. If you have both of those, the money tends to follow. And Atlanta has both those.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Curb Market, brought to you by Perkins & Will and design firm Hirsch Bedner Associates. Let's start by telling people who you are.
Right now?
Yeah, let's do it.
My name is Pamela Joyner, and I'm the manager of the Sweet Auburn Curb Market in downtown Atlanta. And right off the connector, you can't miss it. You probably passed by it 100 times a day. My job is taking care of the building and the people, and also working to bring in new tenants and keep it as vibrant and as interesting as it can be.
Well, what's the purpose? What's the role of a public market?
To me, a public market is it's a way to reflect the city that it's in. It's someplace where you would bring a visitor and say, okay, this is because when you're inside Sweet Auburn Curb Market, it's basically a reflection of what the city of Atlanta is all about. You're going to see all sorts of types of food, all walks of life. You're going to see people driving up in BMWs. You're going to see people driving up in pickup trucks. There's people who have shopped there all their lives. And so I took it on as my job to convert the market as much as possible to a place where everybody could come shop. As leases ended and tenants left, it either we didn't want to renew their leases or they made the choice to leave, we looked at bringing in somebody different and unusual. And sometimes it was just as much fun and as simple as having an urban picnic. Bell Street Burrito came from one of our picnics. And Matt is the owner of Bell Street, and he was selling burritos out of his house to supplement his income. And he gave me one of his burritos, put it on my desk, left it alone, sat for 3 or 4 hours. At some point after the end of the day, I got really hungry, and I took a bite out of it, and I went, wow, this is amazing. This has been sitting on my desk for 3 hours, and it's delicious. So I went to see Matt. He was packing up his table, all his tools. I said, I just that day had somebody move out of the market and had a restaurant space become available, and asked if he was interested, and he said, no, I don't want a restaurant. I said, okay. I totally respect it. Then he finished up, knocked on my door, came back. He put, show it to me anyway. And that was 4 years ago. And he now has 3 restaurants.
That seems very much in line with part of the programming of the Sweet Auburn Curb Market, which is it almost acts as an incubator for businesses.
That is correct. It's actually one of its primary functions. You can have someone like Bell Street Burrito go from a table selling food that he prepared in his home at a table to opening up a restaurant within a matter of 3 or 4 weeks, going through all the permitting processes. And he had never owned a restaurant before, so this was a new experience for him. That's the most exciting thing to me as a small business person, is to watch someone like our praline vendor, Miss D, come in and start out handing out samples of these delicious buttery pralines. She probably wasn't selling more than 10 a day because she sampled more than she sold. And then we gave her a space, and she still makes her pralines right there. In fact, she just added her second pot. And if you ever want to just go watch her make the pralines, it's a very interesting process. And now she's added popcorn, and she is selling popcorn. It's called Falcorn to the Falcons. She is creating her own liquor line. She just told me yesterday she's adding a liquor line of popcorn, tequila flavored, vodka flavored, at the request of one of her customers who is using it for private parties.
Well, she's a true entrepreneur.
She really is. We're treading very carefully on it, but we're looking for beer and wine, and we are looking for a gourmet cheese vendor. And the simplest way to put it is everybody who lives half a mile from the market should be able to walk over there on a Saturday afternoon and get everything they need to have an impromptu dinner party.
One of the things that I think is great about the market, you can go and you can get a gourmet ice cream. You can get one of the best, you know, spaghetti sauces you've ever had in your life. And then you walk 15 feet down an aisle and you see someone selling a cow's hoof.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's like that juxtaposition makes it cool too.
It's a market, and you're going to sometimes walk around the corner and suddenly, you know, smell fresh crab, which isn't always a good smell, but it's, you know, obviously it's a good thing to have. And it really is. I mean, it's an experience. There's no intention whatsoever of eliminating all those really cool, you know, cow's hooves and pig's ears and all those chicken feet that some people do buy. Some chefs buy these items as, you know, as part of what they serve in their restaurants. The Ritz-Carlton was known for buying chicken feet because they used that in some recipe that they cooked. So we're hoping that we're going to get back to that. We're hoping we'll be able to move back in that direction. And I think it represents it's a landmark to the people of Sweet Auburn. And it's a constant. It's something that's always been there. They've always felt comfortable shopping there. They've always been familiar with that. They always know they can go in there and they can find the things that they want to buy. Doesn't need to be pretty and fancy. It doesn't need to go all gourmet. We're just bringing in what's not there, making it a little bit better, a little bit easier. But at the end of the day, the market is part. It's an integral part of the Sweet Auburn district.
the town, she was the toast, really the most. We don't want to boast, but scads of lads would all surround her city, sick or sure what hound. She walked in the marketplace, what did she see? Crew cutting cute with a crazy goatee. What a blend. He was the end selling beans, dressed in his jeans. What a buy. She was heard to cry, I got beans at a bargain, little girl. Won't you step right up? Cast your eyes upon my ware. You will have no other care. There'll be no other worry there. If you see the crazy pair, you'll have one they clean and cooked a crazy on the table. I got them fresh this very morning from the backyard, and I picked them all myself. I hoped you would come along and buy some bees, because what I'm trying to say is they taste so good. They taste so very, very, very good. Take advantage of a bargain, come on and buy some. We got string beans, snap beans, lima beans. We got the very kind of beans that I would like to put right in your fresh cooker, pretty baby. Don't you see what I mean? They're the finest of beans, coolest of beans. They're the best beans that you could find in this or any other marketplace. What are you trying to prove with all your talk of beans? Yes, I know that they look crazy.
You're listening to Sidewalk Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kansas. Today's show, The Curb Market.
For me, when I walked into the market the first time, I personally felt electric, as if there were like the spirits of what could be crawling through me, you know. I'm Keith Schroeder. I'm the founder, chef, and I guess operator, owner of High Road Craft Ice Cream here in Atlanta.
And Stephen?
Stephen, owner, founder of Sunday Gravy NYC, just recently personally relocated to Atlanta. Sunday Gravy, it's an Italian immigrant dish, meal. It's a slow braise of pork and beef, slow braised on the bone for about a dozen hours, and tomatoes and garlic and fresh basil. And then we add Italian sweet and hot fennel sausage and meatballs. And it's traditionally served over, you know, a gusty pasta, like a rigatoni. It's something that I grew up with. My mother was an Italian-American. My father was Irish, kind of a typical match in New York in the 40s and the 50s. And we ate that every Sunday, as do many Italian-Americans, especially from a generation or two ago.
Come on, baby.
I think every culture has their gather around and let's be together meal. And that's always been a personal interest of mine. So when Steven started selling Sunday Gravy outside of his boutique catering company at the farmers markets in New York, I actually reconnected with him when I saw him post it on Facebook. And so I just became an instant fan of the idea. And then over time, we reconnected, and I said, this has to happen. We have to make this, you know, it's togetherness food. And over time, I hope there are a few more cultures we can explore.
Well, that's kind of the thing. Like, you all definitely both have the culinary, the taste, the quality side of this down. But you're also breaking kind of a new ground from a retailing perspective in this roommate situation. You're in the same space, yeah, at the Curb Market, and there's something that's like very logical and sweet about that, but that's also very new.
Yeah, you know, strangely enough, on the practical side of things, it's the fast food industry that's figured that out, right? And you see a Baskin Robbins with a Dunkin' Donuts, or you see a KFC, Taco Bell, and it's a logical use of space for the same kind of craving. And the thing that Stephen and I thought that we had in common with our brands was that they're really serious products. It's culinary-driven stuff that the serious foodie would recognize. And we thought maybe it's not, chocolate and peanut butter, but lunch and dessert or dinner and dessert certainly made a lot of sense to us. Our flavors are representations of people and places. And so that's 100% the mission behind what we're doing. So you have bourbon burnt sugar, you know, why not celebrate a product that we all love to imbibe? Brown butter praline just seems right. A lot of it's just weaving technique and what seems right together, and that we've all seen in dishes that might not be ice cream, but making sure that those flavors are carried through.
Do people come in and say, wait, what are y'all doing here?
Every day.
And what do you say?
We're helping. We're participating. We're learning. And we're test marketing and we're sharing. You know, our price point is not really reflective of being a high-end product, but our prices are high everywhere else. So being down there, just, you know, our philosophy right now is let's just break even and figure out what the heck this thing is going to become.
The people that are down there are, you know, it's not a movie theater. They're there to eat, and they're looking for something that's going to make them feel good and taste good.
Yes, you scream, ice cream. Everybody want ice cream. Rock, rock, my baby, rock. You scream, ice cream. Everybody want ice cream. Rock, rock, my baby, rock.
You've been listening to Cyborg Radio. I'm your host, Gene Kantas. I'd like to thank my guests today, Pamela Joyner, Richard Loeb, Stephen Smith, Keith Schroeder, and Tim Borchers. Of course, I'd also like to thank our sponsors, Perkins & Will and Hirsch Bednar Associates. Visit the Curb Market, y'all. Tell them we sent you, and we'll see you next month.